Hello there, this is Seafood Post by Seafood Jones, and we have a very, very special guest today that's going to be discussing some concepts that I know that probably everybody that listens to this is really going to get an immense amount of value about it. It's one of our Inner Circle members who is an expert on nutrition, and what we're going to be talking about in this session is how nutrition relates to chi power training and how vitally important it is to make sure that you're doing the best you can to get the best nutrients in your body. So what I'd like to do now is introduce Seafood Jones onto the call.
How's everybody going? Yeah, today's topic on nutrition really is going to correspond with the rest of the stuff we're talking about. The better shape you're in, obviously, the better you're going to get energy out of your body. And this is just one of those topics that go hand in hand with chi building or chi power training, and that's eating properly, you know, getting the proper nutrition so that your body will run right, it runs the smoothest. And so today we're introducing one of our Inner Circle members that also studies on that side of the fence, Dr. Thomas Ernest. How are you today?
Doing good, Sifu. How about yourself?
Great. All right. What do you got to say for us today?
Well, I just want to give you a little background with regards to I'm a doctor of oriental medicine and a professor of clinical nutrition, so I've been studying this field for about 25 years. I specialize in nutrition and preventative medicine, pain management, endocrinology, and environmental illness. So there's lots of things out there with regards to nutrition that people are not aware of that can really either build their health or hurt their health. So I've been involved in the martial arts since about 1978. I had an amazing aspect in the 80s when I was training pretty intensely with having lots of arthritic pain in my knees, almost to the place where I was going to have a needless surgery on my knees. And one of my instructors kind of really piqued my interest in nutrition back then by telling me that if I was to cut out the nightshade family of vegetables, that could really be the main culprit in my knee pain. So those are things like tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, paprika, chili peppers, tobacco. And lo and behold, I cut those out for basically a month, and it totally transformed my life. So there's some really neat things that can really change things if you work on doing a little experimenting with your body.
So now, is that because it was like a pH thing?
There's...
You had too much... Why would that work?
There's actually harmful alkaloids in the nightshade family of vegetables, and it's actually can also hurt animals as well. The farmers have come out to fields where animals have eaten different herbs that are nightshades that we wouldn't necessarily eat, and they've been lame and crippled for days. I haven't eaten those things really much in the last 20 years, and so you can really feel a difference if I do have some tomatoes happen to be the worst one for me. If I have them, it actually creates major knee pain for a couple of days, and then it goes, you know, maybe 3 days it takes for it to go away. And everybody's different. A friend of mine from training, it affects his shoulders and doesn't affect his knees. A doctor colleague of mine, it totally devastates her back, her low back. Doesn't do anything to my back. It just affects my knees. It tends to go after the weakest spot of your body. So it's just the harmful alkaloids in those particular vegetables and herbs that can be detrimental to you if you happen to be sensitive. And unfortunately, I'm a sensitive one.
Yeah, because, you know, in the other places, they tout those things as, you know, like tomatoes has got certain things, the lipopene in it, and it's just like it's touted as a big thing. And see, some people wouldn't know that, you know, they're trying to, you know, eat a whole bunch of that stuff, not knowing that that actually could be causing some problems in their own body. So this is some good information, isn't it?
Yep. If you're having chronic muscle or joint or bone pain, that's the first place to look, because it can really. I was about to have knee surgery because it was just hurting so much and nothing was relieving it. No drugs, no nothing. So it's an interesting factor. I've been interested in chi training all the way back to 1984 when I had an instructor back then throw me without touching me. So that really kind of piqued my interest in chi training. And back in 2007, Sifu Benjamin Richardson introduced my wife and I to the circular chi training, and so we've been going full blast ever since. So it's been lots of fun. There's lots of really good things to look forward to, I think. So with regards to health and everything, I just want to really kind of keep it on track with regards to that all of us are definitely chi guys and chi girls, and in that vein, we definitely are controllers of our life, but you want to really take into effect that we can ultimately transmute anything that we might eat or drink or breathe or any pollutants like that, but you also don't want to tempt fate. You know, you want to still, you know, since we're all still learning and developing our chi training, we want to make sure that we eat right from the get-go so that we can save maybe some of our qi for some of the extreme abilities that we all want to be able to do. So in Chinese medicine, we talk a lot about the aspect that a majority of our qi comes from good diet and good lifestyle practices and choices. So that's what this call is going to be about. We're going to talk about a bunch of different things to be able to really boost people's qi abilities.
Sounds great.
All right. So as an environmental illness specialist, there's one thing that we want to really get across is that basically the dream of better living through modern chemistry has really kind of come to be a fallacy, because we're seeing the devastation of the living like that, with people getting more and more diseases earlier and earlier in life that they used to only get in old age. So we definitely, there's lots that we can do with regards to diet and lifestyle choices to prevent a lot of that stuff from happening. Basically, with regards to drugs, you got to take into account that drugs basically have a limit with how much they can help us. So we really have to be able to do a lot of these things ourselves. Drugs are liver toxic, and they also have the aspect of how they work in the body is they actually block necessary pathways in the body, or necessary functions are turned off. That's how they actually work. So basically, you can only go so far with that kind of paradigm before it actually becomes devastating to the body.
And most of them really just treat the symptoms and really not solve the problem or the cause, huh?
Yep, exactly. Yeah, they don't really ever get to the root cause. None of us actually has a deficiency of a drug. It's always some kind of a deficiency of a vital nutrient, mineral, amino acid, something that the doctors just are not being enough of a Sherlock Holmes type of doctor and overturning every type of rock, you know, to find what is actually the main problem. No, they just give you a drug instead. And so part of the whole aspect that I'd like to educate everybody about is to really be able to, you know, reclaim our health and take responsibility to our health to a certain degree. You know, you definitely need to seek out medical attention when you need, but there's a lot that we can do with regards to proper diet and lifestyle aspects.
Yeah, that's what I always say. I mean, doctors are great for, like, if you get shot or you get cut up with a knife or something, great
yep.
stuff, you know, but not to, you know, not for your nutritional needs. Most of them don't really have that ability to hook you up that way, do they?
No, they don't. Actually, most doctors are actually not even trained in nutrition. When I was applying to medical school, basically out of the 135 medical schools in the U.S., only 35 of them actually even required one course of nutrition training. So you can't actually educate a patient on something that you didn't learn yourself. And most doctors, most nurses, you know, when you hear on the radio, ask your doctor or nurse or healthcare provider about herbs or vitamins or minerals or whatever, that's like asking your plumber about them, because they didn't learn that, you know, so they don't really have a good education about that. So basically in the last 100 years, we've really had lots of exposure to pollutants and heavy metals, pesticide residues, antibiotic and hormone residues, artificial colorings, flavorings, preservatives, all kinds of things that we basically are having to constantly detox our body. So there's some things that we can do that can really help. One of the biggest things is the solution to all of these pollution problems is dilution. So one of the things that we want to do is we want to try to minimize our exposure by buying organic or pasture-fed animals, meats and things like that, and fats and oils and produce, so that we can detoxify ourselves regularly and not be able to have much of that type of concentration of pollutants in our body.
Now, is milk actually good for you?
Actually, milk's a really big topic, actually, because one of the big things that's actually happened in the milk world is if you actually pasteurize and homogenize milk, it becomes very destructive to the body. The pasteurization and the homogenization process heats the milk. It actually damages the fats and makes it really difficult to be able to digest it. That's where you get all these kind of folk type of ideas where milk is very mucus-forming and very acidiforming to the body. If you actually go online, I'll skip over to the milk section here. There's actually a website that you can go to that's actually called therealmilk.com. And if you actually go there, you can actually find resources in your neck of the woods, wherever you happen to be able to find someone who's going to be providing you some source of raw milk that hasn't been pasteurized, and hopefully it will also come from animals that are only eating grass. When the animals eat grass, they actually are the healthiest they can be, because when they're eating grass, they actually build inside their own body, in their flesh and in their milk, the omega-3 fats. Those are the fats that are anti-inflammatory. Those are all the ones you hear about the rage with regards to being able to prevent arthritis, to be able to boost up the concentration of the mind. And so all of those things are actually boosted up in the animals that eat grass, so much so that you can actually get almost as much and sometimes more omega-3 fats from pasture-fed animals that live on land than you do from the fish in the ocean. You know, basically salmon and things like that, sardines. Those fish have lots of omega-3 fats from the ocean, but a lot of the pastured livestock can actually have just as much or more omega-3 fats.
Wow. Yeah, I never heard that before.
The other big thing is that you also want to be drinking whole milk. There's been a big campaign in our culture to demonize fat in the last 70 years, and a lot of that is pushed by the pharmaceutical industry, because they're trying to really do the cholesterol-lowering blitzkrieg. They really want to, you know, push everyone's cholesterol down to a low, low point. And basically, here's a fact for you. If you actually take your cholesterol, the total cholesterol, if you push it below 150 milligrams per deciliter, that's how it's measured on the lab reports, if you push it below that level, you actually will have no ability to heal from any disease or bodily conditions that you may have. It actually, in my world of functional medicine, it becomes an ominous marker when I see that on people's lab reports, that that's a dangerous fact. If you go, let me give you a website. There's a website to go to be able to learn more about these different things. I'll give you some more at the end, too. But there's a website called WestonAPrice.org. If you go to that website and you look into the aspect of cardiovascular health and fats and oils, there's going to be an article there that's called Cholesterol Friend or Foe by Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride. And if you read that article, you'll really be able to clarify in your own mind and not have any doctor or pharmaceutical sales rep pull the wool over your eyes that cholesterol is bad. Cholesterol is a necessary item. It makes up our eyeballs. It makes up our cell membranes. It makes up the brain. There's lots and lots of things it fights infection that it does. And so if you push it to too low of a degree, you're going to have major health problems just because of pushing it lower than what the body needs it to be.
And your body actually does make cholesterol on its own, doesn't it?
It does, and that's actually one of the aspects where the whole cholesterol-lowering drugs are kind of a fallacy to begin with, because your liver will manufacture whatever amount of cholesterol your body needs to be able to do the repair job that it's trying to do. Basically, the cholesterol is a repair substance. One of the current theories out there is that we have micro cracks in our artery lining, and that's due to vitamin C deficiency, due to stress, due to inflammation, due to problems with the immune system. And so because cholesterol comes there to repair the cracks, it gets blamed because it's at the scene of the crime. You know, if a person has a cardiovascular event, a heart attack or a stroke or something, they like to blame cholesterol for that. But in a recent study done at the Lancet Journal, they actually found that when they analyze an artery clog, when they take out the fat or the clogging substance and they actually analyze it, they find that 74% of it is polyunsaturated fat. And polyunsaturated fats are the kind that the doctors and the health field tell you to eat, which those are the kind that come from vegetable oils that are actually rancid when they put them in the bottle. And so they're very, very fragile and very easily damaged by heat. And that's one of the aspects that when you create hydrogenated fats, those are all the fats that are used in the restaurant industry, in the fast food industry, and even in the health food industry to a certain degree. Those fats are used in almost anything that you would be eating that encompasses a bread item or a cracker or any type of a breading. And those things are very, very bad for you. They actually mimic plastic.
They actually, what happens is it's superheated up. That's what that means, that hydrogenated, right? It's been superheated up. And so to the fact that these electrons have been knocked out of orbit of the atoms, so that it would cause free radical damage.
Exactly. What they do is they actually saturate a substance. They take a liquid oil that would be liquid at room temperature, and they bombard it in a chemical process where it actually saturates all of the cell bonds with hydrogen. So that's why it's called hydrogenated. So it makes it pasty at room temperature. So like, for example, if you tried to take olive oil and you tried to make a cookie with that, you really wouldn't like the results in the cooking aspect, in the baking part of it. It would create a very greasy cookie. So if a person took like canola oil or soybean oil or any of those oils, the ones they usually hydrogenate, and they bombarded it like that in the chemical process and turn it pasty at room temperature, then they can use it like butter or they can use it like coconut oil, two very good fats, and bake with it so that it has long shelf life and so that it actually is not greasy, but it's actually very, very bad for our health. So a lot of it has to do with they're just trying to be able to prolong shelf life, and they're trying to be able to make a little extra profit.
Wow, yeah.
Yep. Well, let me go back to the milk aspect here real quick, and then we'll jump back to fats and oils too. Let me finish that one. So basically, you want to be drinking raw milk, and you want to be drinking whole raw milk with the cream on top. It actually comes out of the cow that way. It comes out whole milk. It doesn't come out 2% or fat-free or skim milk. Any of those foods are actually Frankenfoods. They're actually fake. They actually, once you strip away the fat from the natural whole milk that comes out of the cow or the goat, you actually have a really difficult time being able to assimilate the calcium and the protein correctly that's in the milk. So it, you know, God made it that way to come out of the cow or the goat whole milk, and that's the way we should drink it in a raw state. There's other dangers of pasteurization and homogenization too. We actually are drinking really dirty milk when we drink pasteurized and homogenized milk, because what happens is the dairy farmers are intent upon pasteurizing at the end of the process when they milk the cows, so they have no interest whatsoever with regards to keeping their milk clean, because they're just going to heat it up and kill off all the bacteria. So basically what you're eating is tons and tons of dead bacteria carcasses, because they never filter the milk, they just heat it up and kill it. So that's another reason why pasteurized milk can be really allergic forming and can create all kinds of major food allergy problems for people.
Now, is that why it also causes heartburn in people?
Exactly. Yeah, because it's actually all of the enzymes, which are proteins that are like busy bees in the body. The proteins, they basically are catalysts for every type of reaction in the body. And so when the enzymes are killed off by heat, that actually creates major drain on the digestive ability of the milk when it's been pasteurized.
Wow.
The other thing is that all of the contamination outbreaks that have happened recently have all been with pasteurized milk. The raw milk got a bad rap long ago, but it doesn't deserve that anymore. You can actually buy raw milk around the country. California is one of the last states where it's totally legal in the state. It's checked. It's certified by the state to be totally healthy, pathogen free, and everything. And so, we go through tons and tons of raw butter a year. Matter of fact, we're just going to be taking a trip out to California to get our year's worth of raw butter, since it can't be shipped through the mail. There's actually a federal ban. Matter of fact, you can buy alcohol, tobacco, and firearms easier than you can buy raw milk in some states.
Wow. That's having your priorities the wrong place.
That is definitely having your priorities the wrong way. So one of the things that that's interesting about raw milk is that when it actually starts to turn, it actually ferments to something else. Like it'll sour and turn into yogurt or kefir or different things. But when pasteurized milk actually starts to turn, it actually rots and actually will definitely give you food poisoning. The other thing that you want to be aware of is that if you really can't get raw milk in your state, some states are really pretty tough with regard to their raw milk laws, and of course it can't transport it across state lines either. So if you can't, your best choice is to be getting organic cream on top yogurt or milk or kefir. And you can turn the organic cream on top milk into yogurt or kefir. You can buy the packaged powdered granules and just follow directions and be able to turn it that way into the whole milk, kefir or yogurt. You can also use coconut milk organic, or you could get organic cream and thin that out with a little bit of water. Or the other option is that you can actually make nut milks. You can get organic nuts, and you can actually make different flavored nut milks to be able to, use almonds or cashews or whatever nut you particularly like to be able to use as a milk substitute.
Now, how about that soy milk?
Yeah, soy milk is actually a really destructive item. You want to stay away from anything to do with soy. If you have any cancer history in your family or potential, you know, history in your parents or siblings, you basically, if you see soy walking on your side of the street, you want to walk on the other side. Soy really should only be eaten if it's fermented. So basically unfermented soy are things you want to avoid, like soy milk, soy cheese, tofu, things like that, soy ice cream, any of those type of fake foods, soy oil, all that stuff is very bad for you. Soy sauce that has not set on the bottle, fermented for 6 months at least, is actually something you want to avoid. They can actually make soy sauce in 48 hours with intensive chemical processes, but it actually creates tons and tons of MSG precursors in that particular soy sauce, which are very bad for you. MSG is actually a excitotoxin to the brain. It will excite your nerve cells until they die. Same thing with aspartamine, the artificial sweetener. They both are excitotoxins and will excite the brain cells until they die.
I know my mom was allergic to both of those things really bad.
Yep. Yeah, basically aspartamine had the most complaints to the FDA when they had it under advisement and people were calling in. I mean, it went from mild symptoms all the way up to death, and they still allowed it to be used in our culture, which is a real shame. So let me go back real quick to the environmental illness things here. There's all kinds of things that you wouldn't think are problematic. They're just so common in our culture that we just don't even think twice about them. A couple of little quick ones I'll mention is we actually have in our teeth, we have mercury, which is actually the most toxic non-radioactive metal possible. And so the silver mercury black-looking fillings that we have in our mouth, those are actually, there's mercury in there. And so, you know, mercury 2 inches from your brain is not a great idea. So it's kind of a funny thing that once the mercury is not in your mouth, the dentist and EPA has to take all kinds of precautions with it. But as soon as it gets in your tooth, all of a sudden it becomes safe. So kind of kooky.
Real kooky.
There's actually another one that you might find interesting, too, because I know some of the Inner Circle members probably are using candles in some of their training. So there's actually some real dangers with paraffin candles. You definitely want to be using beeswax candles instead of paraffin. Paraffin candles are actually petroleum-based. They actually run the danger of asphyxiation if you're in a confined space, and they also put a lot of particulate into the air so that if you were in an emergency situation, like, for example, a power outage and you were burning lots of paraffin candles, you'll have all kinds of black residue and soot all over your drapery and ceiling. So you really want to be using beeswax candles that are 100% beeswax. And here's a funny one for you. It just shows how all of this crazy chemical, you know, stuff that we kind of live in a petri dish. The vanilla scent that's used in typical normal candles, paraffin candles that you would buy, that's actually a drug that's used to kill head lice. And it just happens to smell like vanilla. So that's what we're inhaling when we're inhaling vanilla candles.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So one of the things that you can actually do is, again, the solution to all these pollution problems is you want to be able to, the solution to pollution is dilution. So you want to minimize your exposure, and there's some things you can do that will help. Of course, your daily chi training will help dramatically. You can do fasting one day a week on homemade chicken broth. That actually is a really great way to fast. It's actually very easy on the body during even the cold season. Homemade chicken broth was actually the very first energy drink that was ever made. The first woman who actually swam the English Channel way back in the 20s did it covered in lard and drinking chicken broth. The other thing that you can do is you can do sweat therapy with regards to the far infrared sauna, or doing plenty of exercise, and also eating a clean diet and drinking plenty of water. Those all things will help to dilute the pollution and be able to get it out easier.
Kind of clean out the old pores that way too, huh?
Yep, yep. So the next one I'm going to talk about real quick is water. We definitely want to be drinking clean water. There's lots of chemical pollutants, heavy metals, drug residues, and even purified human waste in our tap water. So you definitely would be advised to be getting a a water filter to be able to filter your drinking water. And the other thing that people don't know about sometimes is that taking a shower, actually, you get more chlorine exposure, which is actually toxic to the intestines and the friendly bacteria that we have there, than you do by drinking a gallon of tap water. So you want to be getting a good, there's a good brand called the Shower Soft Shower Filter. That's a really good one. It's got lots of a pound and a half of filter material. And a good water filter for the top of the counter is the Dalton brand. Those are also good. They also, even Dalton offers a gravity feed stainless steel one that is used by the Peace Corps and by all kinds of disaster relief organizations. So it doesn't require water flow. You just pour the water in and it filters through the big filters and will give you clean water at the bottom.
Wow, great. Now, so another, what about the bottled water? Is there anything better?
No, nothing really any better. Unfortunately, the bottled water can actually create some problems because if you find bottled water that's actually in glass, you'll be doing yourself a good service. But the stuff that's in plastic, a lot of the plastic residues leach out, and they're actually finding that the bisphenol H, which is the stuff that's in the plastic, is being linked dramatically to obesity and diabetes. So basically, you want to try to avoid any plastic exposure, like cooking in the plastic bags where you might cook vegetables or microwaving something in a plastic. You know, microwaving is actually not a really good way to go at all. It actually creates a white blood cell attack against your food. But if you really have to microwave, then try to put your food item in some kind of a ceramic or glass or something, but not in the plastic aspect of things. So on cooking, real quick, basically the big thing with regards to cooking is you basically need to cook for yourself. If you're relying upon the government, a restaurant, a deli, or even the health food store, they're definitely not an advocate for us in this day and age because they're using the wrong fats. All of those items, if you're constantly eating out, you're always going to be getting bad fats. Unfortunately, the food industry is not caught up to the current research, and they're still using the hydrogenated fats, the trans fats, or a lot of the rancid vegetable oils in their cooking. I was at the Grand Canyon a while back, and there was an advertisement for a healthy Chinese food restaurant that said that they were using, you know, good fats for the heart, and they were using corn oil, which is actually a very destructive fat for the heart. So it's just they don't know any better. It's a shame.
And the government isn't going to really give you the good information most of the time. I mean, if for some reason, just like you say, they make you have it pasteurized, homogenized on the milk. They have their priorities the wrong way at times, don't they?
They really do. Yep. So there's a couple of good places to learn to cook. You can actually go to cooksillustrated.com or America's Test Kitchen TV show. Those are actually good places to learn the science behind cooking, but you want to pay attention to the fats that I recommend here and don't use what they recommend. There's some good things with regards to cookware. You want to stick with stainless steel, so no aluminum, no nonstick, no cast iron, no microwaving. Cast iron cookware is only useful for menstruating women. So anybody else runs a very grave risk of iron overload by using a cast iron pot, unfortunately. Matter of fact, there's an interesting thing that happens every year called Teflon syndrome, that the Teflon DuPont company actually gets calls 200 times per year that a person's small household pet bird has died after they burnt their Teflon pan. And they go, yeah, well, sorry about that. Yeah, that happens. What happens is that if you take Teflon above 500 degrees, it actually gives off a toxic gas and will kill your pet bird. It's kind of like being a canary in the mines that they used to use them in the old days to give them early warning. Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty bizarre that, you know, I mean, even Teflon, you think that, you know, because so many people will cook on Teflon, you know, and yet it will, you know, it cuts up easy, you know, if you scratch it and, you know, eventually it starts coming off and it gets into your bloodstream, huh?
It sure does, yeah, and it's very toxic to the body. So, yeah, you want to try to avoid that as much as possible. So basically, the rule of thumb is you want to try to be buying organic as much as possible. Even though organic is actually a little bit more expensive, in the long run it has a lot more vital nutrients, so in the long run it's actually less expensive than conventional food. The big thing that's happening in our country is that everyone in our country is actually overfed but undernourished, and that's why we have such a big epidemic of diabetes and obesity. So we really want to be trying to think about the aspect, if you can think about this every time that you start to eat something, are you going to be eating something that's nutrient dense and health promoting, or are you about to eat something that's processed, refined, nutrient less and health depleting? That's the way to be thinking about it, because, you know, basically we can only eat so much during the day, and we need to prioritize and start making our food choices really nutrient rich instead of nutrient depleted. One of the
and it's really hard to do that, you know, because we get bombarded by commercials on TV, by ads, billboards, you know, that are showing all these good looking foods as far as growing up, you know, because a kid, they gravitate towards the sugar, you know, you actually are brought up that way. And so it's kind of hard to switch, you know, when you actually start getting information like this that are saying, oh, you know, this is really the way you need to do it. It's kind of hard for people to switch, and you know, would it help even just like doing it in little bits, or you know, start doing it on a little scale at first? I mean, like,
sure,
a lot of people may not be able to go right strictly into the way you're talking. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. No, I'm just trying to give everyone the kind of ultimate way, and you know, basically everyone's going to do it to their own degree and their own capacities. The best way to do it is actually to start adding in something before you start taking something away. So add something in of one of the things that, you know, I recommend of a good thing to eat before you start trying to take away something that's a known bad thing. It's a lot easier that way. But, you know, it goes in cycles. Everyone goes through these kind of purging. You know, they try, you know, like a New Year's resolution or something, they'll try to improve things. And so, yeah, it just goes in cycles. And if you get the good information, you can actually, over time, keep doing it little bit by little bit by little bit. Because one of the big things that I always educate all my patients on is that you have to do it in a way where you can actually maintain it. If you go full blast or go overboard, and you know, basically, a little of something is better than a lot of nothing. So if you can't maintain what you're doing, then you need to take a step back a little bit and do maintain what you can. So, yeah. And
that sounds like a pretty good policy, actually, you know, to kind of introduce it a little bit at a time, because sometimes you'll rebel, you know. I mean, if you're
eating,
like, pizza every week or something, and then suddenly, well, we can't have pizza no more. We can only eat this way.
Yeah.
You kind of rebel, you know, and if you do just like what you're saying, add in this stuff a little bit at a time till you get used to it too, you know, because everything, you got to kind of get used to the taste and the feel of it, don't you?
You do, yeah. And a lot of these things are new, you know, some of the new types of foods, you know, with regards to different types of grains or different types of beans or even different types of nuts. You know, a lot of people are you know, we basically don't eat that many variety of food. You know, the typical American has a small vocabulary with regards to words comparatively sometimes, and so do we, the same thing with regards to our food choices. We eat the same things over and over and over again. So to be able to branch out into some of these areas, it takes a little bit of experimenting and a little bit like, ooh, I didn't like that at all. That doesn't taste good. Even though it's good for me, that didn't taste good. So, yeah, you just have to find what you like.
And that's really such a great thing to bring up about the variety because, you know, I mean, yeah, you know so many meat and potato guys, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
That's all they have is meat and potatoes. Either it's a hamburger or a steak or something else that they've – but it's basically that same, you know, not much of a change. And, you know, introducing all these type of things into your diet, you get so many more different types of vitamins, minerals, chemicals that you wouldn't get in just that same meat and potatoes every day, huh?
That's for sure. Yeah, that's what I was really talking about with regards to the aspect of the nutrient dense. You know, I mean, we only have so many meals per day and so much food to put in. And so, you know, one of the things that you really want to try to do is try to eat as many different types of foods as you can. You know, one of the general principles here, I'll jump down to the area of general dietary principles, is that you want to try to make a rainbow of colors on your plate. You know, each one of those different colors has a phytonutrient that's unique to that particular color, you know, like purple or purple cabbage or red beets or different things like that. All the different colors are different nutrients that the body can use. So you really want to be able to have all those nutrients on your plate. That's
kind of a good rule of thumb, is that if it's a pretty colorful type of vegetable, then it's probably one that's good for you, huh?
Yep, Yep, and the real sad state of affairs is that there was some major studying done that actually found that only 11% of Americans actually get the 5 servings of vegetables per day. And basically it's even less than that because they were considering lettuce, iceberg lettuce, and French fries a vegetable. Most Americans don't actually eat much in the way of vegetables. So basically, when you hear that concept of eat your fruits and vegetables, you really want to think about eating more vegetables. And fruits are kind of a little bit overrated with regards to you actually don't have to eat any fruits at all. You can get all of the nutrients you need from vegetables alone. And I'm not saying to be vegetarian. That's not what I mean. I just mean that fruits themselves, if you're trying to lose weight, they're packed with a lot of sugar, natural sugar, and so it becomes a little bit difficult if you're trying to keep the weight down. And unfortunately, our culture is full of sit. We sit way, way, way too much. So most people don't actually exercise enough to burn more than 2 fruits a day, and I mean little fruits, not watermelons. 2 watermelons a day.
Yeah, like an orange or an apple, that kind of thing, right?
Right. Yeah.